the trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
The first week of testimony has come to an end.
It's a spectacle. That's for sure.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
It's always the theories or stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
When the FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder, that never, ever happens.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Defense attorneys learn in school, first class, the most important thing you can do is identify and select stupid juries.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
With a mistrial declared, you'd think that things may have calmed down a little bit, but that's not the case at all. Let's take a look at all of the drama that has unfolded outside of the courthouse, both while the trial was coming to an end and since court adjourned. And buckle up, y'all, because there's a lot of it. On Thursday, June 22nd, one of the final days of trial, Trooper Nicholas Guarino testified that the Apple Health data that shows Officer John O'Keefe ascended and descended three flights of stairs was incorrect, stating that it only registered that because he was riding in the car where there are some hills. That weekend, Aiden Carney, aka Turtle Boy, decided to head toward Fairview Road with multiple iPhones to test this theory out. Carney has been at the center of a lot of the controversy surrounding this case. I've referred to him before as the loudest voice in the room when it comes to the Free Karen Reed movement. And his aggressive journalism style has led to witness intimidation charges in connection to the case, which he plans to fight as part of his rights under the First Amendment. His controversial tactics have been incredibly effective in garnering attention around this case, but those same tactics have also gained him some enemies on the other side. After driving the routes that John and Karen took that night to test the Apple Health data, Carney and his girlfriend stopped by C.F. McCarthy's for dinner. On the way into C.F. McCarthy's, which is next door to D&E Pizza, Carney runs into Colin Albert. Here he is on his YouTube channel, Turtle Boy Live, describing the run-in.
We had to walk by D&E Pizza to get to C.F. McCarthy's. It's right next door. And as I'm walking in, I see Colin Albert. I didn't even recognize him at first. And because he's got like a hoodie on, he looks like he's dressed for the North Pole, and I don't recognize him. And he recognizes me, and he says something like, I can't even go to my dad's pizza shop. And he pulls his phone out. So I pull my phone out, and I took a picture, and then I started videoing it. And this is the video. This is the video. This is actually not my video. It's Meredith taped this.
Really, dude? Come on.
What's up, man?
Really?
See, he's got his phone.
I can't just go get food at my dad's store.
We're just going to see if McCarthy.
He said something to me.
Oh, God, what's happening? We're just going to see if McCarthy. Call the police.
Call the police, he says.
We're just going to dinner.
Bro, chill out. Chill out, bro.
Like, we did nothing. We did absolutely nothing. I'm trying to go to dinner. That's it. This guy's like, really, bro? Really, bro? And I look at him, I'm like, who is this guy? Really, bro? Oh, shit, it's Colin Albert, okay? And you heard him there. He goes, "I'm calling the cops." You heard him there.
McCarthy's, what's the big deal? Oh, God, what's happening here? We're just going to see if McCarthy. Call the police.
Call the police.
We're just going to dinner.
Call the police, bro, and tell them what? What's he going to tell the police? There's a guy going to dinner that I don't like. Call the police.
Carney says that Colin's first instinct to call the police as they're walking by is because the Alberts control the police, and they use the police as a weapon to punish people that they don't like. Carney's girlfriend Meredith is recording, but not pointing the camera toward Colin, so at first you only see the ground as they're walking. Once Colin addresses them, the camera view moves up to show that he was walking away, about to cross the street, as Carney and his girlfriend continue walking down the sidewalk toward their destination. But once Colin says something to them, he turns around and walks back toward D&E Pizza, walking to the door and telling someone inside to call the police. The video also shows that while this exchange is happening, Carney and his girlfriend did continue walking in the opposite direction. Once inside C.F. McCarthy's, across the bar, Carney spots Julie Nagel, one of the witnesses who testified in the trial. Julie is the friend of Brian Albert Jr., who said during the trial that she saw a black blob in the yard, and she's also one of the witnesses that is listed on the witness intimidation charges against Carney. He says that he noticed Julie taking pictures of him and recording him, but he didn't speak to her or say anything about it. At some point, a male that Carney doesn't recognize joins Julie Nagel at the bar and is with her for the remainder of the visit. When they finish their meal and walk outside, Carney is met by Colin Albert, Chris Albert, Chris Albert Jr., Ryan Nagel, and Julie Nagel and the guy that she was with, who turned out to be her brother Sam. They had walked outside as well. Here's Carney describing that interaction and playing clips of the video that he captured on his phone. The first part is Sam Nagel, who came over and put his hands on Meredith, Carney's girlfriend.
So he comes over and he starts like getting aggressive with her, and he touched her. Like, he comes up and he touches her. Okay. He puts his arm around her. Like, and as it turns out, this is Ryan and Julie Nagel's brother, Sam, he introduced himself as, and he touched her. Now, what he wants me to do is like fight him, right? Because I'm on bail. And that, I'm not going to give them that reaction. I mean, that sucks that you can't stand up for, you know what I mean? That you can't stand up for. I can't, like, it's like, it sucks.
You just touch her, bro?
Yeah.
What
are
you saying? You just touch her?
Be a little fucking soft.
She doesn't want you to touch her.
Yeah, that'll
be good. What the fuck's wrong with you?
We had a nice conversation. I just didn't.
Why are you touching her?
I don't know why I'm
just talking to her.
You just touched her, bro.
I'm asking her why she's with a fucking loser like you.
Why are you touching her?
He's not a loser. He's a good person.
Yeah, I don't think he's such a loser.
Fucking hooking up with like a loser like that. Get the fuck out of here.
This is Ryan Nagel, who has now walked up to Carney and is yelling at him.
What?
You don't like Canton. No one wants you here. Get the fuck out of here. I'm a fucking loser guy. You're a loser guy. You and all your fans are big fucking losers.
Guys, a fucking loser. Love the town of Canton so much. He has to come hang out here. Get the fuck out of here, dude. You're a fucking loser. 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 Keep going. Have fun. Have another beer in there.
What are you doing?
Off to the video.
You're obsessed with us.
What do you mean you heard of that?
You're obsessed. It's fucking loser.
Toward the end of this clip, Ryan Nagel is pulling Sam Nagel away, and then Sam says this to Carney's girlfriend.
You're a loser too, by the way. I'm sorry. You're beautiful, but you're a fucking loser. Not as big a loser as this fucking...
So notice that these are the people who are allegedly scared, sitting out here. Again, what was our crime? We came and we ate food at a restaurant. That's a crime. You can't do that. He's going to jail. They're mocking me. They think this is funny. They think this is funny. These are victims of witness intimidation, allegedly.
Jim Ferris, an employee of D&E Pizza, then shows up. And at this point, they're all on the sidewalk in front of D&E Pizza, yelling at Turtle Boy and his girlfriend, who have stopped because basically they have to walk through this group to get back to their car. Jim Ferris approaches Carney and knocks the phone out of his hand, which Carney's girlfriend, Meredith, caught on camera.
Look at this. Look.
Wow, we were just trying to leave and go to our cars. They're all coming up to us. Well,
please.
Oh my God.
Look. fucking maggot.
Oh my God.
You're a fucking maggot.
Put down on your fucking
blog. Holy shit. Oh, we have all of this on our, for the blog.
I'm gonna call the Canton police right now. Let's see what happens.
We got that on video. Oh my God. Right? He just not.
We got that on video, right? We got that on video, Jimmy.
Thank you. What's your name in case we need another witness to this?
Let's see what happens. Maybe we'll get Kevin on the line. We'll see what happens.
This was actual assault.
You getting this off? They seem really intimidated.
In case you didn't hear that, they are now taunting Meredith, asking if she's been a good little girl.
That daddy's going to be in jail when that
baby comes really out.
That's why you beat women. Why do you beat women?
Meredith, what are you doing with a guy like this?
You did eat women. Huh? You're a pedophile.
What are you doing with like an ass
man?
He actually
was just
standing
out
here.
Beautiful
girl. What are you doing?
Are you molesting your own children?
You just touched your
Chelsea. So there's that. Jim Ferris is an employee of D&E Pizza. That's who Jim Ferris is. So there's that video.
As the situation continues to escalate, Sam Nagel comes and stands right by Carney, telling him to walk through here and pointing forward, meaning, come walk through this group of people right there on the sidewalk yelling at Carney and his girlfriend. Sam Nagel continues to taunt him, telling him to take a 5-step walk, which would of course put him right in the middle of their group. The back and forth continues for a while until Chris Albert comes out and addresses Carney. Here's Turtle Boy playing the clip and discussing it on his YouTube channel.
We just wanted to
take a walk down here. Take a 10-foot walk down here, buddy. Take a little walk. Take a little walk. You got balls, right? Real fucking 5'9" man. You got balls. Take a walk. Come on.
So he's telling me to take a walk down here, so like, you know, so they can beat me up or something, right? Like, take a walk down here. Not gonna do that. They're trying to antagonize me. Not gonna give it to him. Not gonna give it to him.
About 10 minutes into this, the aggression continues. Colin Albert yells to Carney that he's going to be in jail for his kids. Chris Albert Jr. yells at another man standing nearby, watching all of this unfold, asking why he's there. Carney fires back, telling them that they don't seem very intimidated, referencing the witness intimidation charges that they filed against him, and stating that they don't seem to be in fear for their safety if they're taunting him and his girlfriend. Chris and Colin Albert are seen on video flailing their arms, mocking Carney, and Chris Albert Jr. yells at this woman, telling her that she looks like a dude, while Julie Nagel laughs at the insult. Chris Albert then approaches Carney.
Justice for Peter Berger. You'll beat. I'll beat your face up and down the sidewalk in 2 seconds. That's what he said. I will beat your face up and down the sidewalk in 2 seconds. This is a guy who has the audacity to go to the police and go in front of a grand jury and say he's scared of me, that he's intimidated by me. On film, he says, I will beat your face up and down this sidewalk. An elected official in town said that.
A few minutes later, a car pulls up and Jill Daniels, the sister of Julie Albert, jumps out of the passenger side, running directly up to Carney. She can be seen on this video grabbing his phone from him and screaming at him.
Yeah, oh boy.
You're a fucking prick.
You know what? I'm so sick of your shit.
Oh,
oh my God.
Look at that.
Wow.
Shit. Like a wild animal.
Give him his phone back. You look fatter than me. Nobody cares.
Yeah, she's normal. Look at me. I'm just chilling.
And wow.
Can I have my phone back?
Give him back his phone.
Give him his phone.
I'm still live.
Give him his phone. You have his property. Give him his phone.
Go ahead and touch
him.
You can't steal his phone.
Are you kidding me? There you go.
Throws it on the ground. And I'm still alive. And I was still alive.
You're a loser.
Yeah, you've said that before. You said that.
I don't care. But guess what? I have a good heart. You are a great heart.
Just let her talk.
You're the one yelling right now.
Let her talk.
Guess what? He's cheating on you.
Don't even talk back. Don't even talk back.
Who are you yelling at?
Who are you? Like, look at you. How many times you got punched in the nose? What if your teeth? You make fun of my teeth? Yours are chicklets.
Zoom in on the skin.
I have wrinkles. I don't care. Guess what? I stick up my finger. How many siblings do you have? Has anyone stuck up to you? No, they don't like you. They don't like you. You guys can all tame me. Like, why are you taming me?
You're rising up and assaulting people.
I'm so sick of harassing my family.
No one's harassing anyone. I'm just trying to eat dinner.
Why are you here? I'm hungry.
17 minutes into the scuffle, the police finally show up, and one of the officers watches the videos that Carney and Meredith have on their phones. Now, by this point, a crowd has gathered on the sidewalk watching all of this unfold. Most of them are recording it on their phones. Minutes later, a news crew arrives from NBC 10 Boston. Carney is still live on his Facebook during this whole entire thing. And once the police are done and the news interviews are done, you can even see person after person coming up and asking to take pictures with him. Carney has become a local celebrity, being hated by some and adored by many others. Both Jill Daniels and Jim Ferris were charged with assault and battery against Carney for their participation in the scuffle. Exactly 1 month later, Jill's temper over the case again flared as she and her boyfriend, Nick Marathis, were permanently banned from a bar called Shipwrecked after they engaged in a fight over the trial. Here's the 911 call.
Taking a 911 call for a physical fight at Shipwrecked. I'll give more info. The unit's responding. The call came in from the manager. She believes it's being diffused at this time, but would still like police response.
Dispatch, you're going to be going on Shipwrecked.
You're dead, man.
You're there.
I'm sure the unit's clear. It was an argument over the Karen Lee trial. And I'll take an OS.
I think the two people sitting on the steps are going to leave on foot, and the other two were going to head out in a vehicle. The one in the pink shirt was okay to drive.
At a select board meeting on July 9th, Chris Albert read an apology letter for his participation in the scuffle outside of C.F. McCarthy's.
Okay, as many of you know, I've had two recent verbal altercations with members of the public outside of my role as a select board. Despite the tremendous harassment, stress, and anxiety that my family, extended family, and I have been subjected to over the past 16 months, my interactions were inappropriate. And as an elected official, I am held to a higher standard, and I understand that the residents of Canton expect public officials to always conduct themselves professionally and focus on the business of the town. I apologize for my recent reaction and will refrain from any further public incidents that I'm becoming as a member of this Canton Select Board. Thank you.
That's not the only controversy for Carney. On July 1st, he posted photos on his X account, formerly known as Twitter, of a large turtle that had been killed and hung from a railing at his parents' house. The post read, quote, "This morning, someone left a large murdered turtle hanging from a railing at my parents' house. It had a hole through its head. The police are investigating," end quote. Now, this horrific display of animal cruelty is especially heartless because it happened at Carney's parents' house just 2 days after his mother tragically lost her battle with cancer. The police took fingerprints of the railing and looked for ring videos from neighbors and took witness statements, all in hopes of finding the perpetrators. The harassment doesn't stop there, though. In a pretrial hearing, defense attorney Alan Jackson listed out evidence that he says supports the third-party culprit defense, and he used this proverbial metaphor.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
After this, there were reportedly yellow rubber ducks left outside of D&E Pizza with the phrase, "Colin did it," written on the bottom. Now, D&E Pizza is, of course, owned by Chris Albert, Colin's father, and apparently, since the mistrial, there were more rubber ducks that were left at the restaurant, which launched an investigation by Yuri Bukinik. While the Alberts were left rubber ducks, Karen Reed supporters were having their yards targeted with bleach-filled balloons that killed their grass. Three yards were targeted, and all three belonged to locals who had been very vocal and outspoken in their support of Karen. One of the victims, Jennifer O'Donnell, stated that she knows that there will be backlash for putting herself out there because not everyone will agree, but she says her home is her sanctuary, where her children are and her pets and her family, and where she comes to feel safe. O'Donnell says that these people invaded that and took that away for her. The targeted harassment in this case specifically is, it's like nothing I've ever seen. The vitriol online is at a level that is honestly very scary. And you don't have to be directly involved in the online arguing to be a target. I myself have been relentlessly harassed, with it escalating dramatically over the last few weeks. My entire life is picked apart. Lies are spread through anonymous accounts. Angry, hate-filled messages flood my inbox and my notifications, and vulgar memes are created with my picture. And unhinged people have even contacted my family and friends. The more contentious this case gets, the worse the harassment becomes for all involved. So, what else has been happening since the trial? On July 3rd, the first interview with Paul O'Keefe was released. Paul sat down with Christina Rex from WBZ-CBS Boston to talk about the trial and some of what his family has gone through during all of this. Paul O'Keefe was asked what he thinks happened that night, and this is his response.
Oh, we know what happened. We know that Johnny and Karen were arguing. It was kind of towards the end of their relationship. Things weren't well. They were drinking and arguing and fighting, and in an intoxicated state of rage and jealousy, she just decided that she was going to do something about it, and put the car in reverse and ran him down and left him there to die.
Paul also says that he wanted to speak out because he believes that the public has been misinformed and that they're only getting one side of the story since his family has stayed silent during this time. He also describes some of the hate that he has endured during this. Yelling, screaming, calling names, getting messages through Facebook telling him he's a moron and that he needs to open his eyes. He says that he doesn't care what people say to him, though, because it isn't about him, it's about his brother. This is, of course, frustrating to hear. I've mentioned the harassment of the family in previous episodes. It's not something that should happen, ever. There's no excuse for it. And I know that people feel very passionate about this case, but there's nobody who feels more deeply about it than John's family. There's no way for any of us to know what we would think or how we would feel or behave in that situation. And we can't expect them or anyone else to see things the exact same way that we do. The family should be off limits, no matter what you believe, and it makes me sad and angry to know that they've been harassed. Paul also addresses the comments that he made to Karen Reed when he was leaving the courtroom after the mistrial was declared. Multiple people inside the courtroom said that Paul said the words, quote, "I'm not done with you yet," end quote. But Paul told Christina Rex that he said, "You are not done yet." He said that during the trial, Karen would smirk, and he said that she never made eye contact with his wife, Erin. It bothered him that Karen was hugging her family after the mistrial, and he said that it felt like she was celebrating to some extent. Paul says that this whole thing has turned into the Karen Reed show. She walks through a crowd that cheers her on, signs autographs, and takes pictures when she goes out in public, and he said that she's living her life while his brother has been gone for 2.5 years. He says that he wants people to go back to who the victim is in this, saying that it's not her, it's his brother. 2 days later, another interview with Paul came out where he spoke to Channel 5 Boston. During this interview, Paul said that he first began believing that Karen hit John because she left John's house with her family after only being there for about half an hour. He also addressed his decision to sit in the first seat in the courtroom, right in front of the camera and only feet away from Karen Reed.
Nobody really wanted that first seat. I'll take the camera on me. But also, I wanted Karen to know that I'm here and I'm not going anywhere and I'm going to be here every day.
Paul also said in this interview that he didn't believe the defense's theory, and he invited Kerry Roberts, Jen McCabe, Brian Albert, and Colin Albert to come sit with the family during closings for that reason. He wanted to send the message that they don't believe it. The drama also goes beyond just the witnesses in the case. It also extends to some of the key players. For example, Trooper Michael Proctor. On July 1st, the news broke that the lead investigator, Michael Proctor, had been relieved of duty, effective immediately. Colonel John E. Maughan, Jr., the interim superintendent of the Massachusetts State Police, released a statement informing the public that upon learning of the result of the trial, the department took immediate action to relieve Proctor of duty and formally transfer him out of Norfolk County District Attorney's Office State Police Detectives Unit. Proctor was transferred out of Norfolk County into Troop H, the Division of Field Services in South Boston, pending a duty status hearing. Maughan's statement said that this follows our previous decision to open an internal affairs investigation after information about serious misconduct emerged in testimony at the trial. He also says this investigation is ongoing. On Monday, July 8th, a Massachusetts State Police Board placed Proctor on suspension without pay, effective immediately. A small crowd that had gathered outside the state police barracks in South Boston cheered at the news, excited to see some change finally happening. Boston 25 News reported that after the internal affairs investigation, the department says that it may pursue charges against Proctor that would be adjudicated by a state police trial board. That same day, footage from NBC Boston began circulating on social media. A reporter in the street outside of Proctor's home attempted to ask him about whether or not he thought that his actions impacted the outcome of the trial. Proctor didn't reply. He actually walked inside his house, but his wife did respond to the reporter, saying, "Get off our lawn." And she said that she fully supported her husband and that Karen Reed is a murderer. Proctor's testimony didn't only impact his career, though. Remember that story about Proctor and Kevin Albert getting so drunk while investigating a cold case that Kevin lost his gun and left his badge in Proctor's cruiser? Well, during a Canton Select Board meeting, the announcement was made that Kevin Albert was also placed on leave, just one day after Proctor's testimony.
Chief Rafferty has placed Kevin Albert on paid administrative leave while an outside and please be quiet. While an outside independent investigation is being conducted relative to his actions in a case he investigated with Michael Proctor approximately 2 years ago, Kevin Albert was placed on leave on June 13th and will remain on leave until the results of the investigation are provided by the outside independent investigator.
But it doesn't end there. On July 23rd, stories flooded the media with the announcement that three other troopers linked to the Karen Reed case were also now facing internal investigations. A Massachusetts State Police representative confirmed to local news in an email that Lieutenant John Fanning, Detective Lieutenant Brian Tully, and Sergeant Yuri Bukinik were each the subject of an active internal affairs investigation. Fanning was investigated and cleared already, but Tully and Bukinik, who both played major roles in the investigation of Officer John O'Keefe, both remain under investigation while on full duty. So for anyone keeping count, that is now four members of law enforcement that remain either under investigation or suspended at this time because of this case. I'll keep you posted as that unfolds. The day after the trial ended, State Police Colonel John Maughan held a press conference to discuss the trial as it relates to Massachusetts State Police, the internal affairs investigation against Proctor, and what the future holds for the department. He was asked what they will do differently to make sure that something like this never happens again, and this was his answer.
Yeah, we're going to continue to look at this, and we are hyper-focused on that right now. We have been in a process for the past 16 months of evaluating places for improvement. We are very mindful that there are always improvements to be made on the Massachusetts State Police. We have drilled down and concentrated our efforts on six general areas, all that are reflective of what we do on a daily basis and how we are perceived in the public eye. We want to continue to make sure that we can provide the services to the public that they demand and deserve. Those areas where we're concentrating most of our efforts now are, I could break them down and say that in no particular order, community trust, legitimacy, and engagement, diversity, culture as a standalone issue for the Mass State Police, examining that both externally and internally, training, leadership and wellness, and media and public relations. Those are the areas that we're focusing on, have been focusing on for the past 16 months.
He also gave this statement to address how the department is going to work to rebuild the public's trust.
Yeah, I think it's incumbent upon us to be in a continuous cycle of earning, maintaining public trust and legitimacy. That's we cannot do our job effectively without that. And we are hyper-focused on being able to do that and conducting ourselves in a way that demonstrates that we can do that and that we are worthy of trust. And as we move forward in this organization, we will be mindful of that, and we will be making sure that we're all doing our very best to show the public that we can be what they need us to be.
I mean, I give him credit for acknowledging that the state police situation at this point is so bad that they have to actually work on public trust and legitimacy. I mean, if the public doesn't even see you as a legitimate organization, that's pretty bad. It's about way more than just mean text from Proctor, though. This is about driving a patrol car drunk and the lack of reports from these troopers and hiding personal relationships and connections to people who are directly involved in this case. And no documentation of chain of custody on evidence like John's phone. No notes on witness interviews. Tons of mistakes and changes in police reports. All of these are huge, huge problems. But I guess acknowledging and addressing that to the public that doesn't trust you, and saying that you're going to look internally to figure out how to make changes, well, that's at least a start. We'll see how things progress and what, if any, changes are made. So as crazy as all of this is, it's still not the craziest thing that's happened since the trial ended. Let's talk about the jurors. On July 8th, Karen Reed's defense attorneys filed a new motion to dismiss two of the three counts that she faced in connection with John O'Keefe's death. Why? Because they said that the jurors actually acquitted Karen Reed on count one, which was the second-degree murder charge, and count three, leaving the scene of the accident resulting in death. So, how is that possible when there was a mistrial, right? Well, that's what the defense is pushing to clarify. In the defense's motion, they say that the jury reached a unanimous decision to acquit Karen Reed on those two charges, which would mean that she can't face trial for them again because that would be double jeopardy. Double jeopardy is a procedural defense that prevents an accused person from being tried again for a charge after either acquittal or conviction, or if there's prosecutorial or judicial misconduct, like in the recent dismissal of charges against Alec Baldwin for the shooting death that occurred on the set of his new movie Rust. The problem here is that the judge declared a mistrial without the jurors having given the verdict form with the two not guilty boxes checked for those specific charges. So the Commonwealth will argue that it wasn't an acquittal, so double jeopardy wouldn't apply. But the court didn't ask the jury about whether or not they were in unanimous agreement on any of the counts. So how would they know? There are a lot of things that happen off camera, and the public can't see the jury, so when all of this happened, I kind of just assumed that there had been a conversation before the judge came in and that they were back on the record and the cameras were rolling, but there had already been a conversation. But apparently that never happened. So instead of having that conversation to clarify or asking if they were stuck on all three or giving further instructions about how to turn in two of the three if they were unanimous, she just called a mistrial. Now, the defense says that after the mistrial was declared, they began to receive unsolicited communication from 3 of the 12 deliberating jurors, indicating that the jury had a firm, unanimous 12-0 decision that Karen Reed was not guilty on 2 of the 3 charges, including the big one, second-degree murder. Their argument is that this unanimous decision means that she can't be tried on these, and they ask that the court conduct a voir dire of the jury and or an evidentiary hearing to substantiate the existence of an acquittal. So if the court holds a post-verdict inquiry on the issue, it allows the defense counsel to seek additional proof from the jurors about their decision. They have to request this because under Massachusetts law, they aren't allowed to contact the jurors and ask. Also, the attorneys are not allowed to ask jurors about their deliberations. That's a no-go. But they are allowed to ask about the split of the jury. So this is another area where things will get sticky here, because if you're asking about the split and it's 12-0, that's fine. But then asking about why the verdict form wasn't filled out or asking about the vote on it, could that be inquiring about deliberations? And if so, where does that leave us? Would they be able to just limit the questions to where the questions remain in the parameters of case law? Bringing the jurors back into court to ask them about all of this isn't necessarily common, but it's also not unheard of. When there were allegations of misconduct from court clerk Becky Hill in the trial against Alec Murdoch, they brought each juror in to ask them questions on the stand about what happened and if their verdict was influenced by anything that was done or said by Becky. Now, they said no, and the judge decided that the verdict stood, and that was that. So, what about these jurors? Could this be an option for them, too, to bring them in and question them? Let's take a look at what the defense is actually saying about the jurors, right after this. So, let's start with the first juror that reached out, Juror A. The mistrial was declared on July 1st, and the following day, Juror A reached out to attorney Alan Jackson, stating that they wished to inform him of the quote-unquote true results of the jury deliberations. The motion reads, quote, "The jury unanimously agreed that Karen Reed is not guilty of count 1, second-degree murder. Juror A was emphatic that count second-degree murder was off the table, and that all 12 of the jurors were in agreement that she was not guilty of such crime," end quote. It says that the jury also unanimously agreed that Karen Reed is not guilty of count 3, which was leaving the scene of the crime with injury or death. So that one is clear. They said not guilty on counts 1 and 3. The following day, July 3rd, defense attorney David Yannetti was contacted by 2 different individuals who are not jurors, but who said that they had received information from 2 different deliberating jurors. Now, this part gets confusing, so follow along with me. The 2 jurors that are being referenced here are going to be referred to in the legal documents as Juror B and Juror C. So let's look at Juror B's story. This person that contacts Yannetti is referred to in the documents as Informant B, since they gave information on Juror B. And there's also a person listed as Intermediary B, who had a text conversation with Juror B and then sent it in to Informant B, who gave it to Yannetti. So basically, they're saying that this juror, Juror B, was texting a friend and talking about the trial. And the juror said, quote, "It was not guilty on second degree and split in half for the second charge," end quote. Now, these texts go on to say that once the judge gave the Tui Rodriguez charge and sent them back to deliberate more and to look at the other side, that's when things turned into a bully match. But nobody in there believed that Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe on purpose. They also said that they didn't think that the prosecution proved the case. So after this conversation, the person that the juror said all of this to sent a screenshot of their conversation to someone else, who then sent it to Yannetti. Now for Juror C. This is a similar situation. There's an informant C and there's an intermediary C, and in this case, they all 3 know each other. The juror and the informant used to work together, and they have a mutual friend who actually still works with the juror. So here's how this one went down, according to the affidavit from David Yannetti. The day of the mistrial, this person who contacted Yannetti, the informant, had posted something on Facebook about the trial. So after seeing this post, the mutual friend, who still works with the juror, texted the informant and said, "Hey, our buddy over here was a deliberating juror on that trial." So the informant then texted the juror and talked about the case with them, but only in kind of general terms. Apparently the juror was saying that they were relieved that it was over and talked about what an exhausting experience it was and things like that, but nothing very specific. So after their conversation, the informant goes back to the mutual friend and is talking about all of this. The mutual friend says that Juror C is going to do a Zoom call with some of their friends and talk about what happened with the trial. Now, after that Zoom call, the mutual friend who was on it texts the informant back and gives the scoop on everything that was said. The screenshots where this person is giving them the scoop on this were then sent to Yannetti. So here's the text from the mutual friend that was on the Zoom call. Quote, "No consideration for murder 2. Manslaughter started polling at 6-6 and then ended deadlocked at 4-8. End quote. It goes on to say that the juror was very consistent in the fact that they could only consider things that were admitted into evidence and ultimately was not guilty vote because the death was twofold of hypothermia and head injury, and this juror wasn't convinced that the vehicle caused both. Now, something else that's interesting here. The juror said that the whole jury felt very intimidated by Higgins' presence at the end. Now, of course, Brian Higgins wasn't there at the end, but Brian Albert was. And if you see the video of the way that he sat directly across from the jury and stared forward with a very stern look, I'd probably be intimidated too, especially after the testimony about how even the police chief was scared of him. The informant asked the mutual friend about Karen being acquitted on the charges that they all agreed weren't even an option. And the friend said, yeah, she should have been acquitted because it was the remaining charge that they were hung on. But they said that the instruction paper was very confusing. And I agree. We're going to go over that in a minute too. On Monday, July 8th, another juror, Juror D, reached out to attorney Alan Jackson, stating that they were uncomfortable with how the trial ended. Jackson filed a supplemental affidavit in support of the motion to dismiss, and in that affidavit, he says that Juror D said that the last day of trial was a whirlwind, and everything happened so fast. Juror D's perspective was that the jury was brought into the courtroom, the note was read, the mistrial declared, and then the jury was rushed out of the courtroom. Following a brief meeting with the judge, the next thing they knew, they were on the bus, and the end of the trial was all just really confusing. The affidavit says that Juror D said that it was troubling that the entire case ended without the jury being asked about each count, especially counts 1 and 3, because they reached a not guilty verdict on those. And the sole disagreement was about count 2 and the lesser offenses. Juror D also said that they actually discussed telling the judge they had agreed unanimously on those 2 counts, but they weren't sure if they were allowed to say so. They thought that they had to come to a resolution on all counts before they could report the verdicts. Remember that sentence, because we're going to go over the instructions in a minute. They thought that they had to come to a resolution on all counts before they could report the verdicts. The juror said that they talked about it and decided to inform the court that they were deadlocked, thinking that they would get some kind of further instructions about the other counts, the ones that they did agree on. But that instruction never came, and that was confusing and upsetting. Juror D felt like other jurors felt the same way because they told Jackson that when they were on the jury bus, many of them appeared uncomfortable with how it ended, and they were wondering, is anyone going to know that we acquitted her on counts 1 and 3? Because no one ever asked about those counts. Juror D remained very uncomfortable with the result of everything, stating that it just didn't feel right because they had reached verdicts on 2 of the counts, and Karen might now have to be retried on those counts, and that's just not right. Jackson said that he asked the juror if the others would acknowledge the not guilty verdicts on those 2 counts, and Juror D said that every one of us will agree and acknowledge that we found her not guilty of count 1 and 3, because that's what happened. The juror also said that they would be willing to testify to explain that to the court and tell them about the unanimous verdicts, as long as their identity was protected. Now, there was also an alternate juror who spoke to a reporter and said that she was disappointed and frustrated, and it was really difficult to sit quietly during 5 days of deliberations, unable to be the one deliberating with the jurors, but having to remain available just in case. The juror also said that she didn't feel like the Commonwealth was able to convince her beyond a reasonable doubt that Karen was guilty. She also said that watching both families during the trial was tragic and difficult, and she said that Proctor's testimony didn't have an impact on her beliefs of guilt or not guilty, that even without it, there wasn't enough evidence to convict. Now, this juror wouldn't know anything about the acquittal of counts 1 and 3 because she wasn't a part of the deliberations, but that was her perspective to the reporter. News reporter Christina Rex posted that a juror actually spoke to her, confirming that the jury was unanimous for acquittal on counts 1 and 3, but that they were hung up on the second count of manslaughter and the lesser included. So now we're hearing this not only from the defense, but from a reporter. The juror also told her that they considered being more specific in their notes to the judge, but they weren't clear on how they were supposed to communicate their unanimous decisions on charges 1 and 3. That same juror also said that they reached out to the Commonwealth, who didn't respond, and to the defense. So, what was so confusing here about those instructions? Looking back at the end of the trial, when the jury instructions were given to the jurors, the instructions given by the judge are critical here. Now, you'll remember that there was some argument over the verdict slip and being confusing on count 2, and there was a change made to it, as well as the judge giving additional instruction. But the verdict slip pages for counts 1 and 3 didn't change. The problem is whether or not the jury understood that they had the option to return a verdict slip for some of the charges, but not for all of them. Was that made clear? Here's Judge Beverly Cannone giving that instruction.
Remember that the decision of the jury must be unanimous in the foreperson. Should be certain that each member of the jury is in complete agreement with the verdict. After the final vote of the jury, the foreperson should check the appropriate boxes as to each charge, then sign and date the verdict slips and notify the court officer that you have reached a unanimous verdict.
So I can understand why this would be confusing for the jurors. The instruction is that all three have to be unanimous. And she specifically says that the foreperson should check the boxes after the final vote of the jury. If they didn't reach a unanimous verdict on all three, then they wouldn't have made it to the point where he checked the boxes. There should have been some kind of clarification for them. And it's kind of scary that a person could face trial again for charges that they've already been found not guilty of. If Judge Cannone denies the defense's motion, they'll definitely appeal the decision, at which point these words will be crucial for determining the final decision. Remember that juror saying that they thought that they had to come to a resolution on all counts before they could report the verdicts. That's kind of what the instruction says. The Commonwealth filed a response to the defense's motion to dismiss. Now, here's what's interesting about their response. The purpose of the Commonwealth is to pursue justice, and everyone involved in the legal system should have that same thing as their number one priority. I would think that if you're hearing information that there could be a chance that the jury reached a unanimous verdict, you would definitely want to check that out. Make sure that you're pursuing justice in a fair and constitutional way. I would also think that knowing that the world is watching and that they're already furious with how things have been handled, I would think that you would want to at least acknowledge that and assure the people that you are there to represent, the entire Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that you want to take every action possible to ensure that you are doing the right thing and that you are seeking truth and justice, not just a conviction. But what do they do? Well, not that. The Commonwealth's response is basically, too late, too bad, so sad, and they don't want to hear it. The filing says that the jury explicitly indicated an impasse on all charges, and the court carefully considered alternatives before declaring a mistrial. Y'all, that is false. The jury never said anything about all charges, much less explicitly. The note that was read said that they are unable to reach a unanimous decision about charges. But remember, the one that they were hung up on was count two, which had lesser included charges along with it. These are apparently the ones that they were arguing about. Now, the response also says that the defendant's claim is unsubstantiated, sensational, and lacks any merit or legal foundation. I want you to remember that sentence. The Commonwealth's first argument mentions the previous times that the jury had sent notes about being deadlocked, and they talk about the defense telling the judge that they felt that the jury had deliberated enough, and if they can't agree, then to go ahead and read the Tui Rodriguez charge. It then goes on to say that the representations that were made in the affidavits from the defense about the jurors have no legal bearing on the mistrial. That is wild. To say that the jurors' statements about reaching a unanimous decision and being confused about the verdict slip and turning it in, that has no legal bearing on a mistrial? The Commonwealth is saying that the law is that a verdict is admitted on record from the foreman in open court, and since that didn't happen, there are no verdicts. And yeah, that's how law works, but the reason that there's so much case law on different issues that make exceptions and changes to the law as it's written is because the whole purpose of the law is to pursue the best interest of justice. If you're hearing that the jury unanimously found her not guilty of those charges, then why not do the right thing? Why not just retry her on the manslaughter charges? That's the only charge that they were split on. The chances of getting a murder conviction on this case, it's slim to none, let's be honest. The case was one of the weakest that I've seen for murder. So why not just do the right thing in the interest of justice? The way that the law is written, it's not enough for the jurors to have agreed on some things at some point during deliberations. It needs to be the unanimous decision at the time that the verdict is given, or in this case, the mistrial was called. So if they all still agreed on not guilty for the other two counts at the time of mistrial, that should be enough. And with multiple jurors saying that that's the case, I don't know how the court could possibly refuse to call them in and question them about this. Also, that sentence I said to remember about the response saying that the defendant's claim is unsubstantiated, sensational, and lacks any merit or legal foundation, well, turns out, jurors also reached out to the Commonwealth. On August 1st, the Commonwealth filed a post-trial notice of disclosure with the court about the claims regarding the jury. Now, the disclosure says that on July 21st, Lally received a voicemail on his office line with a juror who gave the name and seat number. And the juror's voicemail said, quote, "It is true what has come out recently about the jury being unanimous on charges 1 and 3. End quote. 5 days later, Lally received another voicemail from the same juror that said that they can confirm unanimous on the charges for 1 and 3 as not guilty, and the last vote taken for the second count was a 9-3 split toward guilty for manslaughter on the lower level of manslaughter charges. So, what does Lally do? Nothing. Lally said that he didn't respond because the Commonwealth is ethically prohibited from engaging in discussions about the jury's deliberation process. Y'all, I read this and I wanted to scream. This isn't about the process. This is about the outcome. If you're going to discuss this being because of ethics, think about the ethics of trying a defendant twice for a charge that a jury already found her not guilty of. The filing goes on to say that three other individuals identified themselves as jurors and emailed the Commonwealth, saying that they wished to speak anonymously. The Commonwealth responded by saying they, quote, "welcome the opportunity to discuss the evidence or the Commonwealth's case. However, we are ethically prohibited from inquiring as to the substance of your jury deliberations. That would include your individual or the jury's collective thought process, the content of your deliberations, or the reasons for your decisions," end quote. Again, none of that is what matters. It's just the outcome. That's it. The response to the jurors goes on to say that they can't promise confidentiality and that the substance of any communications may necessitate disclosure to the defendant and the court, at which point all three declined to further communicate with him. So basically, not only did he tell them that he basically just didn't want to hear it, but he told them that he can't guarantee their anonymity. So he's making them scared of their identity getting out to the public. Judge Cannoni ordered the jurors' names be impounded and kept anonymous. The defense kept them anonymous. But Lally's like, nah, I don't know about that. Might want to just keep it to yourself. This is not justice. And it's quite alarming, to be honest. Let's talk about those jurors' names. With the case being so high profile and garnering such significant and divisive attention in both Massachusetts and across the nation, and even globally, the court issued an order of impoundment of the jurors' names in order to protect them from the risk of personal harm to the jurors and to the integrity of their service. Now, the impoundment was set to expire 10 days after it was ordered. However, during that 10 days, a juror filed an affidavit with the court asking that the judge keep their names private because this juror said that he or she was in fear for their personal safety. The affidavit says that the juror is in fear of their personal safety and the safety of their family if the names in the jury are released because they read the impoundment order and on the very first page it mentioned individuals associated with the case being charged criminally with intimidation. He or she also remembers testimony from at least one witness who described her and her family being harassed because of their involvement in the case. And because of that, he or she said they're fearful. The affidavit also mentions that the jurors could hear the protesters outside screaming and yelling while they were deliberating. Also, the members of the jury would meet at a secret location and then they were transported by bus to the courthouse. Now, once the mistrial was declared, they were taken back by bus to this secret location. But when they arrived, there were what appeared to be members of the media there, including photographers. The juror said that they were so freaked out that he or she actually pulled over on the side of the road on the way home to see if someone was following them. And nobody was, but that was the fear that this juror had. The affidavit also said, quote, "If juror names are made public, we will be constantly threatened and harassed, and there will likely be a physical confrontation at some point," end quote. It goes on to mention news articles that discuss people who have very strong opinions on the case, and about the jurors who deliberated. They have seen articles, comments to articles, and postings about the verdict saying that there are some very nasty and dangerous things, showing outrage that they didn't acquit her or showing outrage that they didn't convict her. An article from the Boston Globe is also referenced, and this article says that the anger level was at a 9 before, and now it's at an 11.5, and it characterized this as a quote-unquote rising rage. Someone interviewed in the article said that people are insane about this case, and if they don't agree with you, they'll try to dox you. The juror said that they understand dox to mean release personal information, including their home address, their job, their work address, etc., and that would bring unwanted exposure to the juror and their family. Now, I've mentioned before that social media in this case has gotten out of control, and the vitriol behind some of these posts and accounts is, it's a level I've never seen. The juror has apparently been scoping out the social media of some of these incredibly aggressive accounts, referencing public Twitter posts from Julie Carpenter, an account called Heels in the Air, and a video that Julie Carpenter posted with a clip from Turtle Boy. Here's the first clip. This one is the one that was posted on Julie Carpenter's Twitter. On that post, she says that Turtle Boy has behavior of abusing jurors and said that the jury is not safe.
I do know. I have full faith in the foreman. The foreman is like, he's very erudite. Like the language that he used in his notes, man, those were works of art, weren't they? The foreman is a former cop. Okay, that's the former cop. And you couldn't pick a better juror than this guy. He was a cop in New Hampshire, actually. I know the exact town because I got his LinkedIn. I got his LinkedIn. He's the only one of the 12 jurors where I have first and last name 100% confirmed. I have sent him a Facebook message just in case he didn't see it. I sent him a request, a friend request. And this dude, I'm not going to say his name. I will not say his name. We're not doing that. But this dude was a cop for 5 years in New Hampshire. Not saying what town. And he left. He didn't want to be a cop anymore. And guess what he left policing to do? And I like the kind of guys that leave. Like, that's the kind of guy you want. The kind of guy that leaves policing. That's the kind of guy you want. He was not Westwood. So I was wrong about the town. I was told Westwood. He was from New Hampshire. And he was not retired. He's like, he's probably my age. And he is a doctor now. Like a surgeon, actually. He's a surgeon. So like that's what we're dealing. Like the foreman's a brilliant person. Let's just put it that way. And the smarter the better. That's the way I look at it. The smarter the better. I just don't believe that anybody like that could. And I saw him every day. He was sharp and, you know, well dressed and looked like he was paying attention. I know he was one of the not guilty. He's one of the not guilty people. So
he then talks about his frustration with any jurors who may have voted guilty for the manslaughter charge.
The others on the jury, I don't know. There had to be more than one. That's one thing we heard. He said members of the jury, you know, have reached this conclusion. And I think that, I mean, I'm just looking at that. I'm like, who's the fucking idiot? Like, that's what I want to know. I'm just looking at these people like, who is the fucking idiot on this jury? That's what I want to know. Who's the fucking moron who, after hearing the Arca guys, was like, yeah, Karen Reed did it. I'm 100% positive. Yeah. Lucky Lockhart didn't see a body. I'm 100% positive it was Karen Reed. Brian Higgins called Brian Albert at 2:22 in the morning, and their excuse for that was it was a butt dial while he was having sex. But I'm 100% Karen Reed. Yeah, sure, Karen Reed did it. Like, who's the fucking idiot that did that? Who, like, seriously, who? And oh, you shouldn't be doxing jurors. I'm not doxing anyone. First of all, the list is not public. But if you find out names, I can write about that if I want to. You have every right to do that. That is not doxing. That's called reporting. Whoever did that subverted justice. Like, they're fucking, like, they helped cover up for a murder. Like, that, as far as I'm concerned, fuck them. That's what I think.
And here is the clip of Turtle Boy from the account Heels in the Air on Twitter.
Impoundment of jurors' names during trial. That's one they're going for. Why do you think they want to impound the jurors' names? Because who outed the Chestnut juror? Remember that? The one woman on the Michael who hung the Michael Chestnut trial in, what was that, July? The jury lists are public. So I got the jury list and I went down the list and I found the juror who hung the jury. And I shamed them, as I should, because it's shameful to do that to Sidney Chestnut and Michael Chestnut's parents and Michael Chestnut's kids. It's shameful. So why wouldn't I do that?
In this clip, Carney references the hung jury on the Emmanuel Lopez trial, another trial that had Canone as the judge. The jurors' names were made public, and Carney wrote about the juror who hung the jury with a not guilty vote. Another trial was conducted, and Lopez was found unanimously guilty for the 2018 murders of police officer Michael Chestnut and 77-year-old Vera Adams. He was sentenced actually this week to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 40 years. The affidavit mentions a quote from Turtle Boy. Quote, "Murderers and those who cover for them do not deserve to live a comfortable life while Karen Reed suffers and fights for justice for John O'Keefe." End quote. The juror says that if it's believed that the jury helped cover up for a murder, and that means that he thinks that they should be targets of harassment, then it makes him or her fear for safety. Though the affidavit then says that the fear is not limited to just this particular blogger or a particular side of the case. They also reference two postings from a reporter who was in court defending against a harassment charge against her and pursuing a counter-harassment charge, and also mentioned in a post about getting protection from another blogger. The filing says that it is evident that people on all sides of this case have acted irrationally and aggressively over the past few years. And in light of the mistrial, there seems to be no end in sight to the irrational behavior which clearly continues today. This request, of course, was approved. Judge Cannone said that the juror's affidavit established credible and reasonable fear that the publication of the list identifying the names of the impaneled jurors will present a real and present risk of personal harm to jurors and to the integrity of their service. So the names are impounded indefinitely. On July 22nd, a status conference was held and new dates were set. The judge set the date of August 9th at 2 p.m. to hear the oral arguments on the motion to dismiss. She then said that she knows that what she decides on will be appealed. So in order to have plenty of a time, she wants to schedule the trial for January 27th, 2025. The divisiveness of this trial and the tension that it has garnered isn't limited to just the people involved directly. And the issues with the police and the government officials in this town aren't limited to just this investigation and prosecution. There are people that I've talked to from Canton who are terrified to give their real names and fear that they'll be retaliated against for their beliefs on this case. There are major issues here, and change is needed. The Canton Select Board meetings are packed full of people who want their voices to be heard because they're tired of being trampled over or bullied or ignored. The meetings have been getting increasingly more contentious, and a recent one brought in some fireworks. The issues with the police department and state police have to be fixed to prevent things like this from happening. And the people who were involved need to be held accountable so that changes can be made. I introduced a little bit of the tragic case surrounding Sarah Birchmore, but y'all, there's so much more to it. Over the last few months, as I've looked into this one, every new detail simultaneously breaks my heart and ignites rage at the injustice that she was shown, both as a child and later as an adult. In the coming episodes, we're going to look deeper into the Sandra Birchmore case, and you'll recognize some of the same names in this case that we've been discussing here for the last year. We'll also hear directly from the Canton residents, their own words, their own concerns, their own issues with what's happening there. And take a look into the select board meetings, where Chris Albert still serves as a selectman. Also, I heard back from the engineer who has decades of experience with Techstream data, and he had a lot to say about the information that I sent him and the way that Trooper Paul interpreted the data. That will be on the next episode. We still have a lot to cover and a lot to uncover, and things don't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. I'll be offering subscriptions to 13th Juror Podcast in the near future, where members will have access to extended and bonus episodes. So I'll keep you posted on that. Also, don't forget to check out Magic Mind. It's made a huge difference with me for focus, energy, and stress levels. Go to magicmind.com/juror and use code juror at checkout for your discount. You can find the link in the description. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.